Boop-a-doop-boop-boop. Druids and cars go into festivals. They can chat about things. It's a druid podcast in cars.
Sometimes the best parts of festivals are the discussions that surround them, reflections on what we did and heard, anticipation of what's to come, and processing what it all means in relation to our spiritual work. We wanted to help either introduce you to that phenomenon or extend it for you. That's what this is about. I'm Reverend Jana Vende.
And I'm Reverend Michael J. Dangler. We're priests of Arnriach Fane and members of Three Cranes Grove ADF in Columbus, Ohio. We're recording these sessions actually live in cars, actually going to festivals and events, so you will hear road noise, turn signals, and navigation prompts. But that's part of what makes it fun.
So, sit back and enjoy Druids
in cars
going to festivals.
Today we're sitting outside. We are, I guess, Druids in lawn chairs sitting around a fire.
Yes, more adjacent to a fire.
Yes. And today we are joined by my wife, Maggie.
Hi, friends.
Because we're talking about senses and ritual. Specifically, this was a request, right?
I don't remember.
I think it was a requested topic about how we experience ritual in the various five senses. But it turns out that there's actually more than five senses, like, legitimately. And so Maggie's here because she's kind of a bit of an expert in that sort of thing. So we're going to work our way through them. But first, we want to talk about kind of what it means to experience ritual in a sensory way. And this, there's a lot of different parts to that. But our initial thought was just to kind of go through senses and talk about how we experience them. So, the usual five senses that we talk about are, of course, taste, touch, smell, sight and hearing.
Yep.
And beyond that, there are a couple of additional ones, which are the vestibular.
Yep.
The
proprioceptive and interoceptive.
Thank you. It's nice when someone can pronounce them all correctly. I found out about these mostly because my son has some sensory issues, and we were trying to figure out how they worked, and we ran into particular issues with those.
So the way that I like to explain kind of the differences is with the five that everybody's aware of, the sensory data, and I'll pause by saying that all of the information that we collect about our environment, our world, both internally and externally, all of it comes through our senses. That's just kind of basic science fact of life. It is how we sense and perceive and navigate our way through the world. And so with the five that everybody's aware of, that sensory data is originating from outside of our body. You know, even with food and the sense of taste, we're putting it into our mouth, but it's originating from external sources. With the additional three, and again, it's the vestibular, the proprioceptive, and the interoceptive, all of that sensory data is originating from within our body. The forces that influence it are obviously affected by external factors as well, but the things that we are perceiving with those three are, again, it's originating from internal sources.
Excellent. Thank you for that. This is the reason that we've got Maggie here, because I can't explain stuff like that. I just don't know how. So when we traditionally think about those five senses that everyone's really familiar with because we learn about them in school, obviously when we think about how we hear in ritual, we often think about the experience of a guided meditation. Someone explains to us what's going to happen in our internal vision eye. And that's a really easy one. Or when someone's speaking a word of praise or something like that, you hear all of that as they pontificate around the fire. or speak their praise.
There are also ones that, particularly as we've moved virtual, like, there's sounds that are missing.
Yes.
So, like, one of the things that, for me, really makes in-person ritual, like, makes me connect to it, is the sound of the fire when you make offerings. And it crackles. And, like, we're sitting next to the fire now, and I can hear it. Like, it's crackling. And so that is, like, a very... Tactile is not quite the right word, but it's like a very...
It's got texture to it and depth.
Yes.
Yeah.
And there's also a sense of, and again, this is bringing it back to those internal things, but there's a sense of our body awareness and our positions in space and relative to other objects that that is guided by that vestibular sense. And we'll talk more about what each of them is later, but it's that interplay of the sight and your position in relation to other people, or the sound in position around you. So it's a 3D experience of the sound, not a 2D experience of the sound, and that's not a perfect analogy, that audio versus visual, but I think that you get what I'm trying to say. It's not a single point of the sound originating from the speaker, it is surround sound, and that is much more organic experience. And it's the pressure differences of air movement and that internal feeling and sensing of the vibrations of the music or the drumming or the reverberance. Is that a word?
Resonance, I
resonance,
think you're looking
thanks.
For. But
I can't word.
I know where
I
you're
sound
going.
Smart, but whatever. It's all a lie. That resonance in your chest, and that's that interoception of that feeling of those vibrations internally and the way that that's impacting your inner core. And it's all of those that are our brains kind of meticulously and instantaneously knit together into this very, multi-sensory, immersive experience that is so fundamental to being human and so fundamental to our ability to connect. So I'm a therapist, for those of you who are not aware of that. And one of the things that we were trying to figure out when we all transitioned very quickly to telehealth, why it felt so much more draining. Even though we were technically pretty much doing the same work, there were some adaptations, but a part of what that was is because there's that, you know, almost imperceivable delay when things are like the video and the audio and everything is syncing up, there's still going to be a very slight delay, and it's enough of a gap. So kind of like the conversation version of the Uncanny Valley,
yeah,
if you will, mm-hmm, of your brain is trying to sync these things up, or like when you're watching a video and the audio and the video file are not quite synced up. And so if you're spending hours a day doing that and your brain's kind of trying to fill in the gaps and make sense of it, but there's so much that's missing in this void that it's very taxing in a way that I think none of us were familiar with.
Yeah, and part of that also comes from the fact that when we're doing virtual ritual or virtual telehealth, you're also getting compressed digital sound, which is not analog sound. And so there are whole parts of what a human can hear that are just left out. They're clipped to keep the size of the file small. Mm-hmm. And as a result, everything sounds a little bit different. But you also, when you're doing virtual ritual, you're in your home. You're not outside. So the sound field is completely different than what you're used to. And it makes it very different to do ritual, I think. Not to mention that, you know, it's one thing to use electronic format to do things like audio driving or sonic driving,
mm-hmm.
which is a beat on a drum or something like that, where you're trying to achieve a certain speed, where you're going something like a certain number of beats per minute, and that can drop you into a trance. I think it's 270?
210.
210 beats per minute. And if you hit that it can turn something in your brain and it drops a lot of people, including myself and Jan, into trance.
Very quickly.
Yeah, every so often I'll be explaining it, and I'll hit that 210, and Jan will look at me and she'll say, stop!
Very quickly.
Yes. So that's part of it, too. And that's something that we don't get to do in virtual ritual all that much. It was okay using different electronic things when we were doing things like auditory confusion, which is where you play one sound in one ear and another sound in another ear. It could be two different books on tape. It could be two different kinds of music. But what that does is it confuses your brain. And
it peels your brain apart, and your consciousness drops into the middle of that void as the two halves of your brain are breaking.
Yes, that's exactly what happens.
It's fantastic.
The way that I describe it is that it sort of deepens you in. So I think that drops you into that void is exactly that.
It's called dual attention stimulation, in case you want the technical terminology for it. And it is one of the fundamental principles of EMDR, in case you were wondering.
Excellent.
It peels your brain apart.
Yes.
And you drop into the middle of it.
Yes.
And I just call it auditory confusion.
That's cool. I mean, we don't specifically use that, but it's the same basic premise.
Yes.
Fascinating.
So those are ways that we deal with audio. Mm-hmm. Visual, I think, is also pretty obvious. It's one of the things that I've told a lot of people in the Grove is, you know, the reason that we get dressed up in white robes for the Dublin Irish Festival is so that we all look kind of similar. So we all look like we know that we're supposed to be on stage, and we all look like we know what we're doing.
It's all a lie, people.
It really is. but by dressing similarly in those nice white robes, or wearing our druid whites, as we like to say, because they're not all robes, it gives that impression that we know what we're doing, and that impression is important to actually appearing to people like you know what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Sight is also, when we are leading, like, guided meditations, is the one that's the super obvious, here's what you see while you're in your vision eye. See the trees appear before you. Like, it's the super obvious one that we use for trance inductions and guided meditations and such.
Yeah, most people find it easiest to kind of visualize and see in their mind's eye. Not everyone can do that. Mm-hmm. Some people prefer other senses. I've known people who the only kind of guidance that they can do is auditory. So if you're not telling them what they should hear, then sometimes they can't get anywhere with a guided meditation. I did meet one person who never saw or heard anything in guided meditation, but they could smell things, which, you know, for better or worse, worked out for them. they could tell who their guide was because their guide smelled like a certain brand of cigarettes that their grandfather used to smoke.
I have so many questions. Hashtag your wife is a therapist.
While we're talking
about...
You
might want to edit that bit out.
While we're talking about sight, I think it's really important to mention styles of divination.
Yes.
I mean, for most divination, you use sight, whether you're looking at cards or oracle things.
But also for things like water and fire scrying, sight's a really important part. There's other types of divination, like there's auditory where you collect the sounds around you and stuff. But I think most commonly we run into sight-based divination.
Yeah.
Which is especially cool with fire scrying.
It really is. And we talked about that in a previous episode.
Yeah.
One of the interesting things is with the shop at the Magical Druid, we created a set of Braille Oum, which were really nice because we could do that, and it was just, it was fun. And so I sent it to a couple of people who were blind to test it and kind of figure out how it would work. The first ones were too small, and you couldn't feel the difference, but we got them. We got them down eventually, and we still do them sometimes on special orders, but that was a, that was an interesting thing, but it was trying to access sight through touch and provide the tool in an accessible way, which I don't remember how we stumbled onto that in the first place. I think it was the fact that we were using a laser engraver and we could change the height of things, and it just, it worked out really well, and it opened up a whole new level of divination for folks who could only read Braille. And when you get cards, you know, you can get your own Braille punch and punch them, but there's not a lot of accessible ritual tools that try and access other parts of our awareness. So that was a nice thing to be able to do. When it comes to smell, one of the things we often say in ritual with the Earth Mother is we talk about smell her perfume on the wind, and trying to give people that sense of place with the scent of the area that they're in. That's been a fairly effective and evocative technique, and it's one that our grove has used for a very long time. Reverend Jenny Hunt actually introduced that particular phrasing into our liturgical work.
I think one of the things that I have noticed most recently with smell, since we went so long not being in person, is that now when I put my stole on, it finally smells like smoke again, and that's very much like this centering myself into the work, because it's just one more sense that's telling my brain and telling my body that, hey, this is what we're getting ready to do. And so I think just those sensory triggers are very important, and smell is a, like, huge sensory trigger. So in particular, the smell of, like, certain incense or smoke.
Certain things on the fire. I love the smell of olive oil and hazelnut oil burning on the fire. Those always, of course, evoke for me the feeling and the experience of fire as a spirit itself. And that's a lovely thing to get to experience, too. One of the other things that I've noticed, especially coming back from the pandemic, in fact, just last night we had our first fully in-person ritual for the Grove, one of our druid moons. And we were unmasked, and everyone was vaccinated, and we were able to touch and hug if we wished. Not everyone hugged, but we were able to if we wished. And being in close physical proximity to people again after so long of not doing that was a clear reminiscence of how it had been in the past.
Yeah.
So that's a common thing. We used to have people hold hands during the attunement. So we raise up our hands, and you could feel the branches reaching to the heavens.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'd have people reach out and hold hands and feel that connection flowing back and forth. We haven't done that in a very long time either, but that was a very common thing in our rites for a long time.
Yeah, I still like doing that when we've occasionally brought that back.
Yeah. A lot of people take off their shoes for Earth Mother evocations or for the entire
rite. Or just the whole ritual.
Yeah. That's not uncommon.
If there weren't so many ticks down at the Nematon, I would probably do the same.
There is that. But it's a nice feeling to sort of feel yourself really rooted to the earth with your bare feet. Some people like to kneel down and kiss the earth as well.
We also have it during purification, like the feel of the water hitting your hands, or if someone is aspurging you, you know, like raining down on your head and your face, or this feeling of washing your hands and touching your face.
Yep. Wafting smoke into your face from the incense as it comes around, or the grasses or whatever.
Yeah.
So
we note occasionally when we're doing Waters of Life how heavy the water pitcher is, I think, is a
yes.
It's an important sense, and depending on how many people are at ritual depends on how heavy that water pitcher is.
Yes, it does. And the differences in strength we've noticed as well. Yes. I can hold that pitcher a lot longer than you can sometimes, and I can hold it further out from my body.
Yep.
Just based on the way that I'm built versus the way that you are. So we've figured out how to do that, and if you're doing the waters, we try not to overfill.
We try not to overfill that pitcher, because yeah. Man, is it heavy.
I mean, it holds almost a gallon. And if you're holding a gallon, which is 8 pounds, out
from
your body.
In addition to a glass pitcher.
In addition to the glass pitcher.
It's a hefty glass pitcher.
It will very quickly sap your strength, and you'll end up with shaky waters.
Yeah, that's why I normally support it from the bottom at that point.
Yeah. But speaking of the waters, one of the things that we used to do is we used to add about a teaspoon of honey to the waters and boil them, and we'd have honeyed waters, which gave it a nice little taste. They stayed clear, but it would change the taste of the waters to something slightly unexpected. Hmm. Then we ran into someone who was allergic to honey, and we stopped doing that. You know,
that's really neat, though. I know Reverend Lauren Mart in Texas has a special, like, recipe that she uses for the waters. Which I got to experience when I went down for ordination. But it was really, it was, like, the best way I can describe it is ambrosia, because it was, like, kind of like tea, but kind of like honey, but kind of like water, just all mixed together, and it was, like, the perfect temperature, like, just barely warm. Yeah. So there's cool things you can do With taste, yeah. And I mean, like, there's groves that offer, like, water and mead, or water and ale.
Water and whiskey.
there's a lot of things that you can do with the taste during the return flow portion. You also can touch on taste when you're coming out of trance. There's a lot of people that use salt for grounding. And yeah. I know a lot of people are like, put your fingers in it and feel the salt. And I'm like, no, I'm putting some of that in my mouth, so that I can, like, get a shock to my system to bring me back to center.
Yeah. And, of course, potlucks.
Potlucks.
Yeah, the community building of sharing food and being together and experiencing those tastes, especially when people bring ancestral foods to a potluck, so something that they grew up on and that they loved, that, I think, helps to draw that connection and bring us together as well. Yeah. So we've covered what? Taste, smell,
sound, sight, touch.
Yeah. So we wanted to talk about these other three senses as well, because as Maggie and I were chatting about them last night, because Jan and I were going to talk about this, I suddenly had a bunch of insights as she was explaining each of these, and I was like, oh yeah, well, we need you.
We need someone who knows what they're talking about with these other senses.
Exactly.
Okay, I know what I'm talking about in terms of this. All of the rest of the stuff y'all are talking about, I'm a dumbass, so. Okay, so I'll start with a vestibular. And usually when I'm explaining these things, I start there because it's actually the first sense to develop in utero. So, fun facts. And so the vestibular is, there are three, within your ear, there are three fluid-filled channels that act like the body's levels. And so the vestibular is responsible for your sense of balance, your awareness of your body's position in space relative to the ground as well as relative to other objects. So this is how you know that you're laying down or sitting up, even if your eyes are closed and you have no way to visually orient. The vestibular is what allows you to do that. It is really, really integral to, integrated with the visual sense. So everybody's had that experience of sitting at a stoplight and your car is stationary, but in your peripheral, you sense movement, and suddenly, because another car is kind of rolling to a stop, and you, for that split second, feel as if you are moving, and that is because of that interplay between the visual and the vestibular. When I'm doing trainings on this, I'll have people stand up, a whole room of people stand up and put their arms out and stand on one leg. And then, you know, everybody's doing it with their eyes open, and then I have them close their eyes. And within a couple of seconds, you can see people kind of start to wobble, because when you're standing on one leg, there is that you're balancing, but you're using that sense of disequilibrium in connection with the visual that allows you to manage that sensation and to accurately balance yourself.
A cool thing that immediately brings to mind is the crane stance, where it's a magical stance that Lieu of the Long Arm does at the Second Battle of Moytoira, where he stands on one leg, points with one finger, pulls his other arm in, and then closes one eye and stares down the enemy line. And every so often, I will do that in ritual. There's a similar stance in, I think it's called the Diviner Stance. I'll have to go look it up in Felicitas Goodman's work for ecstatic body postures. And it's sitting and pointing and being on one leg, and it kind of activates that lack of understanding of exactly where you are and shifts you into a different level of consciousness.
Yep.
The other thing, of course, is sometimes during visualizations or particularly deep trance, my body will either start to rock or I will feel as if everything has changed and shifted.
That's what I was going to say, that this immediately brings to mind for me the feeling like when I, one of my internal checks where I know that I'm in trance is when all of a sudden, even though logically I'm probably still sitting upright, I feel like I'm tilted like 45 degrees to the side.
Mm-hmm.
And you just like, that's one of the tells that I know that I've actually hit trance, is that apparently the vestibular sense gets all wonky. Yep. And tips me sideways.
And I have found that pushing through that sensation,
yeah,
and coming out on the other side of that with the knowledge that, no, I'm actually still upright, even though I feel like I'm 45 degrees off, it's a Dutch angle. I feel like I'm in a Batman villain's lair. But getting past that and getting past the discomfort of sitting in a certain position goes a long way toward helping me understand and get into that trance space.
Yeah, I think it's also when you think about the Oracle of Delphi, who would sit on a tripod and hang backwards to kind of remove that sense of where she sat in relation to the world. Would kind of activate that same idea.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and one of the other major things that the vestibular sense does is there's a huge degree of body awareness, and again, position relative to other objects in your environment, but then also a sense of safety. And I'm wondering, because with trance there's a required level of trust, mm-hmm. like a significant required level of trust, trust in those around you, trust in the spirits and those that you're on that path with, and that requires pushing past that sense of unsafe. When, you know, like Michael mentioned, our son was diagnosed with sensory processing disorder, and this was one of his major areas of concern at the time, was a vestibular dysfunction. And so basically his body never felt safe ever.
Yeah.
And so learning to control that a bit within the magical realm, I think, just has a lot of implications.
Yeah, I think about, and as we're talking about this, what I'm thinking about is the notion of becoming unmoored, of letting loose, as if you are a ship on the water, casting off from the dock and letting yourself go with the flow of the experience, the flow of the river that you are on, the flow of the waters. That image kind of speaks to me of what we're trying to do in trance. We're trusting the river to take us where it's going to go. We're following the boatman who's guiding us. We are along for the ride.
Yeah, and I definitely like that idea of trust. When we do oracular save work, one of the safeguards is that you have the seer who's sitting in the high seat, but you also have the guide who sits next to them. And essentially their job is to make sure that the seer is okay, that they are not getting lost in trance, that they don't fall off their chair, that they're not in trance for too long.
Mm-hmm.
And that's their job, is to make sure the seer is okay. And so that is like that safe bubble that lets you hit that trance space because you know there's yes. someone watching you.
And I want to come right back around to that when we talk about the next one. So we were going to talk about the interoceptive.
Interoceptive, yep.
Yep.
So the interoceptive is your awareness of internal organs and bodily functions or processes. So hunger, satiety, thirst, tiredness, energy levels,
temperature regulation.
So it is what allows you to notice, oh, hey, I'm getting cold. I better put on a jacket. Oh, that fire's hot. You know, or it's really hot outside. I should take off my jacket, whatever. Also, you know, having to pee or poop, totally just said that on a podcast. It's cool.
There's a reason that we do a pre-ritual pee before ritual.
Always a pre-ritual pee.
Yeah.
It's like the guiding forces of my life is a pre-ritual pee.
and that's why, too, when we do initiations, we make sure that people have gone to the bathroom, that they've showered, that they've done all these things.
Because... and that they're dressed appropriately for the weather.
Exactly. And, you know, if they're going to be hung from a tree upside down, that, you know, that's not going to have any negative medical impacts or whatever we might do.
Yeah.
Are you hanging people upside down?
We can't say.
I'm not at liberty to discuss.
Y'all, I really don't like this, like, cahoots shit that you got going on. I love you both dearly. So obviously when there's problems with interoception, you know, it can lead to all kinds of issues, because it can also alert us to things that are wrong. You know, it... racing heart rate because our amygdala has detected some sort of threat, or I don't know. I mean, I could go on about the examples, but you get the point.
Yeah.
You know, and if we're ill, or, you know, things like headaches, stomach aches, heartburn, pain, all of that is interoception.
Mm-hmm. And the reason that I wanted to bring it in here is because you were talking about a person who watches and make sure that the person who's in trance doesn't fall over or, you know, stop breathing or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And when we do trance work sometimes, especially when we do things like initiation, we make sure that there is someone assigned when the trance work is that in-depth and we're doing it as a group, we make sure there's someone assigned to make sure that the person who's doing the work is still breathing, that they are still functioning, that they can hear us, that they can see us and tell us if something is wrong.
And it's not even in intense trance work. I know when I lead, like, guided meditations on Samhain, at Grove Rituals, like, part of what I'm doing in that moment of silence, go meet your ancestors, is scanning the room. And sometimes it's to see if people are crying and I can bring them some tissues. And when you call everyone back, you're looking for everyone's eyes to open and make sure that they have all arrived back on this plane of existence.
Yes.
Well, and one of the things with trance is, and this is kind of statement of the obvious, but you are disconnecting from bodily senses.
Yes.
I mean, it is very much all of that internal sensing, perceiving, but in a different way than is typically conceived of as interoception. And so if you're not monitoring that, you need somebody to help you do it safely.
Yeah.
And my brain is going down a polyvagal theory.
Yeah.
Well, reel it back, Maggie.
We've got friends, though, who do things like body piercings and stuff like that. And they go into trance with that experience. And they have to have someone who knows what they're doing to help them through to make sure that they're not, you know, completely
going into shock.
Exactly. or something like that.
Trance, and I'm going to go, like, take a step down the rabbit hole, but then I'll reel myself back in. trance and dissociation are the same neurological pathway.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's the level of intentionality and control.
Yes.
Yes.
And the way to do that safely is to have an anchor in a sense of safety and connection.
Yep, and that is why when we do initiatory trance work in particular, it's all about consent.
Mm-hmm.
We make sure that the person knows that they are in control,
mm-hmm.
that if they want to stop, they can stop.
At any point.
At any point, and we don't hold it against them. You know, if you go in for an initiation with an ADF, and you get, I don't know, halfway through the initiation, you say, I'm done, I need to stop. That doesn't mean you can't do it again. That means that we respect your request to stop. And afterwards, when we've all cooled down and we've figured out where we're going to be.
I'm just going to interrupt really quick because we have an owl friend. That's all.
Hopefully they can hear it on the podcast. Once we've all figured out where we are and we've gotten all of our senses back and they're under our control again, we can talk about what it means to then try it again.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a big part of how we ensure that the safety remains, is by being upfront about that fact and being clear that, you know, yes, you can fail this initiation, but that doesn't mean that your work is a failure. That doesn't mean that we are going to drop you and say, oh, guess you can't do that, and prevent you from trying again. Our aim is to help.
Mm-hmm.
And we try and be very clear about that. The last sense.
Proprioception.
Yep.
So, proprioception is anything involving your muscles and joints. So, think heavy work activities, push-pull, lift-carry. So, kids, for example, with ADHD, with the particularly hyperactive kids, they have a high proprioceptive need. They are very proprioceptive, sensory seeking. And those sorts of behaviors are to try and scent and maintain or achieve a sense of equilibrium internally. Weighted blankets, which are super popular, and I cannot tell you how thankful I am that they have come down in price and accessibility. 10 years ago, you had to go to an occupational therapy website and pay $300 for something that you can get for $60 at Target now, which is fantastic. But that deep pressure works on the sense of proprioception. Burrito blankets, you know, when you wrap yourself up tight, a nice big hug, pushing on things, all of that is proprioception.
And my first thought when you started describing proprioception last night was the tarp fiche, which is a bull sacrifice in which the poet wraps himself in the hide of a freshly killed bull.
Juicy.
You didn't tell me that part.
And then lies in a cave wrapped in this hide, wrapped tightly in this hide until morning.
It wasn't like tanned or anything?
Oh, no.
So, thank you for eliminating that detail over dinner last night. I deeply appreciate you, my love.
And
15 years together, people. This is how it works.
Yep. And so wrapped tight, and then when the first ray of light appears on his forehead, he receives the awe and the inspiration, and it flows out in poetry.
And blood.
So gross.
I mean,
okay. Anyway, sorry.
This is ancient religion. This is how it was. But that particular process, the wrapping in the bull hide,
and particularly that tight wrapping.
Yes. As soon as you said that spoke to me of that. And it, I mean, wrapping yourself up in a burrito style blanket is a good way to manage trance.
And for a lot of people that's a very safe. It harkens back to swaddling babies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the womb, our motions are very limited. They're very restricted, and there is this kind of constant inward pressure from you know, being in a womb and whatnot. And so we swaddle babies, and there's, for a lot of people, that inward pressure brings a sense of safety. Now, when I'm, you know, exploring proprioceptive options to help people regulate, et cetera, I generally say about weighted blankets, like, you either really like them or you really don't. There's not much of an in-between. But it doesn't have to be inward pressure. It can be you exerting pressure. So this is where I'm venturing into areas that I'm not an expert in. But, you know, at Lunasa, we do the heavy lifting games, those feats of strength. That's all proprioception.
Mm-hmm. And it's how you can connect to those ancient heroes. And indeed, I think that the safety aspect of it as well is very important when you talk about achieving trance, because there are a lot of people who aren't comfortable with trance.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a way that you can sort of pull that comfort in, find a way to push on something, find a way to swaddle yourself in something. You know, lift heavy things.
Like the tote full of all the ritual gear.
Like the ritual tote, yes.
Like the 50-pound jug of water.
Mm-hmm.
Because you were describing that. I'm like, that's appropriate. No, hold it, Maggie. We're not there yet.
But, yeah, I mean, there's so many different ways to sort of access our senses. And as you said at the beginning, Maggie, the access to those senses is how we experience the world, and it's how we experience ritual. And being able to draw those things in and find ways to creatively access them, I think is very important. And it's if you're having trouble with trance, consider reaching out beyond the five senses and look at these other three. See if there's something there that you can pull yourself in on.
And I think when we are, as ritual technicians,
yes,
designing rituals, designing trance inductions, that it behooves us to include as many of these senses as we can, not only because the more senses we can input into a single person, the fuller their experience will be, but that way for the person who is lacking sight or sound, still gets all these other senses to help them connect to their religion and to their spirituality.
Yeah. I'm not sure that we can wrap everyone in a blanket, but maybe one of these days.
Our healing blanket is not that big.
Our healing blanket is not that big. I mean, that's another good application, though. I mean, the healing blanket, that's what people do, is they wrap themselves in it, and it gives them that sense of safety and healing. So, yeah, I mean, we do a lot of it. We don't always know that we're doing it.
Yeah.
Most of the time we don't know, because this is just inherent to our experience as human. And everybody uses these things to regulate, to help manage distressing emotions or just intense emotions or experiences. It's just the way that we move through the world. And when you can, as you know, have your sensory goggles on, if you will, can help you enhance it and make a much more meaningful experience.
Yeah, and knowing about them and having words to put to them, and we'll spell them all in the show notes. But
do I need to write them down for you?
Nah, I got them. I got a dictionary. It's cool. But the knowing about them and understanding them and being able to name them gives you more tools as a ritualist. So I can guarantee you that Jan and I are both going to consider these
even more. Considering these.
Yep.
Fun tidbit. I'm going to throw this out there. There are two human activities that engage all eight senses simultaneously. Eating and sex. Just going to leave that right there.
Indeed.
I at work, I lead staffings and trainings of other therapists. And we were talking about this, and I threw out that tidbit, and then it launched into this conversation of, like, how does eating involve the vestibular, and how does sex involve taste? And it was just this very complex, and I'll let y'all think about that on your own. You're welcome.
And that is a perfect way to end. Thanks for listening, and there's more to come.
We welcome your ideas and questions. If there's something you would like to hear us discuss in a future episode, please drop us a line at druidsandcars@threecranes.org.
If you'd like to donate, you can do so at threecranes.org/donate.
Druids and Cars Going to Festivals is a production of Three Cranes Grove ADF in Columbus, Ohio. Our theme song's lyrics were written by Arthur Shipkowski, and the music is written and recorded by Mike Biershank.
Learn more about our grove at threecranes.org, and more about druidry at adf.org.
As always, keep circulating the tapes, and let us pray with a good fire.